a deep dive into the book bag today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Read any good books lately? Well, Roald and I have for Scribble. Roald, when this whole business began of being isolated at home started, I phoned Barnes & Noble, and I said, I want to order 4 books. Can I pay for them over the phone and you ship them to me? And they said, sure. So I named 4 books I had read about in literary journals, and they shipped them over to me, and I have read 3 of them and am into the 4th one, which is huge. And I must say, I've had fun. These are such good books. How about you?
I have, by sheer accident, read 4 books, too. And by accident, I mean I had no intention of reading books that have to do with family relationships. But all 4 of these are books about the effects on children of a family that is being torn in 2 directions. I was going to ask you, I mean, this might be a preface to it. What do you think this period of isolation, which we're all going through, sheltering in place, is going to do to families?
I don't know. My family is spread all over the continent, but we stay close. It's funny, I can be separated from a friend for years and not feel the slightest loss of friendship over distance. Not at all. And I've said it must be that Wootens do well at a distance because we all are on good terms with each other, very affectionate, and we're each in our own world from Alaska to Florida with stops in the state of Washington and Denver. And then, of course, right here in the Quad Cities. But across that distance, we do fine.
On the other hand, this isolation, putting families together for long periods of time, among other things, it's led to a lot of comments like teachers aren't getting paid as much as they should get paid. one little statistic in all of this is that in the past 3 weeks, the calls about child abuse in the Quad Cities have gone up.
Yeah.
So is this going to be detrimental, you think, to the family structure, or are people going to rediscover, eating together and watching television together and playing games and puzzles together? Or is the tendency just going to move off in both directions? It'll get worse for some and better for others.
When I grew up, most families were 3 generation. Most houses had 3 generations of
right.
Grandparents, parents, and kids. And you were born into that, and you lived with that. There was an old joke, that the reason grandparents and kids are so close is because they have a common enemy, the parent.
Right.
But one of the effects of the Second World War was we began to separate by generation. You had the senior
right.
citizen enclave, the parents, and then the kids who were in Little League, and we led separate lives. Now, all of a sudden, we are together, for many people closer than they want to be. But in those days, you learned to adjust. You didn't get out of your neighborhood even. It was a rare thing to go downtown. It was easy to do, just jump on a streetcar and away you went. But every night, all the people on our block gathered together in front of Ms. Montgomery's big yard, brought over their lawn chairs, and they sat and talked while the kids played. So we were accustomed to closeness, but we're not that accustomed these days.
No, but so do you think after it all dies down, there's going to be very little change? Or do you think this will really make some kind of a difference? For instance, in how often people go out to restaurants, which before we got isolated, for the average family was 3 times a week.
Yeah.
Is that going to go down to once a week, or as people discover the joy of sharing a meal together in their house?
Well, you got the answer to that. There are a lot of people who would like it, but I have no idea. I don't think you can predict anything for the outcome of this. It's hard to know. I know the earth is suddenly a cleaner place because people aren't traveling in cars. It's amazing the pictures they take in downtown areas. The air is so clear. Suddenly we're not putting much carbon in the air at all.
Even in China, I mean, you can see the mountains. Yeah.
It's just incredible. But books are great.
Well, I happen to have come across 4 books, as I said, that deal with this tension within families that tends to draw blood together, right? We're blood relatives, and at the same time that tends to separate them into conflict.
Give me an example.
A book that you gave me began it all, Where the Crawdads Sing.
Oh, yeah.
By Delia Owens. I don't normally read bestsellers. This has been on the best New York Times bestseller list for 75 weeks, I think, now. But it turned out to be really an interesting read. And it's the story of a young girl, Naya, N-Y-A, who essentially lives by herself out in the swamp because her dad's an alcoholic and disappears. Her mother has run away. They can't find her to send her to school. And so she is a nature child out in a swamp on the coast of North Carolina. Her dad disappears, and she's forced to make a living digging up mussels to sell to an old guy at a boat store in a little black town in the middle of the swamp. But she does know the swamp. I mean, she knows nature in a way that nobody else knows. She knows the crooks and the crannies. This traces her growing up from about the age of 11 when we meet her through puberty and sex and things like that as she comes across other people. She meets, obviously, 2 kinds of guys, one who is concerned for her and teaches her to read, another who has intentions on her, and it turns out to be a murder mystery because somebody is killed and everybody in town blames the swamp girl. She's got to have done it. She's got to have done it. But it doesn't appear that she can do it. But it is a beautiful story of the way in which, families are torn. They interfere with each other. They get on each other's nerves. But at the same time, there's some pull there that makes us want to be part of a family. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it is a very good read.
Well, I have one that I think is a bestseller. At least it was advertised that way, but it sounded so intriguing, I sent for it and immediately read it. The title is enough to get you going. Deacon King Kong.
Ah.
Deacon King Kong, who is also known as Sport Coat. King Kong is an alcoholic brew put together by his friend Hot Sausage. And he is so addicted to it that although he is a deacon in the local church, they call him Deacon King Kong. And this is the most fascinating collection of characters I've ever run into. This is just an amazing book. It's about a group of black people living in New York, near the docks in kind of a ghetto. The central point of this is a courtyard with a flagpole in it where a young man is selling drugs. And all of the people in this are just riveting. They're beautifully drawn characters, colorful language, and a fascinating story. There's so many threads through this. Where does Jesus cheese come from? The church has all this cheese to distribute every week, and you don't find out where that comes from until you've forgotten about it completely, and then later on you're given the answer. You also know that this young guy who's selling drugs is a hot baseball prospect, and Deacon King Kong used to put together baseball games. He wants this boy who is up to no good to be a baseball player. Also, Deacon, who's known mostly as Sport Coat because he wears one all the time, is constantly conversing with his wife, Hetty, who, as it happens, is dead. But the conversations and arguments between them go on and on and on. This is a fascinating story. I mean, it just unspools with one layer of characters after another. It's funny. It's really funny. It's moving. It's impassioned. And just when you're into the rhythm of things, suddenly there's a love story that pops up. The most improbable love story. And later on, by golly, another one. And the way all this resolves itself is just masterful. If you want something that'll fascinate you and entertain you, you can't do better than Deacon King Kong by a prominent black novelist, James McBride, who has won the National Book Award before. But dear me, that's a book that anybody can read and enjoy, and I've
read a couple of good reviews of that, and I do want to read it. So
oh, yeah. Well,
I will borrow it from you.
If we can clean it off, give it to you. Give me
the
another
next,
book.
The next book I read, I picked up over at Barnes & Noble just because the title intrigued me. The book is called The Long Bright River by Liz Moore, L-I-Z Moore. It turns out it's a mystery. A long, bright river is a phrase from Tennyson's The Lotus Eaters. The Lotus Eaters, who are Odysseus and his crew on their way home to Ithaca, end up, and those who eat of the lotus plant are forgetful, and they forget the past, and they live in the present and the now. And the title, it turns out, refers to one of the two sisters in this book. It's the story of two sisters who have grown up in a totally dysfunctional family. But one, as we see them in this book, has become a cop, a detective, and the other has become an opium addict, horrible opium addict, and a prostitute. And they have not spoken to each other for 10 years. The sister who's a cop kind of keeps an eye on the sister who's a prostitute and hears about her comings and goings and stuff, but has nothing to do with her. And until a serial killer begins killing prostitutes in this part of Philadelphia. And the sister who's a cop is afraid that her sister is one of the victims and decides to track her down. And the whole story deals with the way in which the sister cop tracks down the opium addict. And I don't want to give the ending away, but the ending will satisfy you, I think, immensely. But anyway, it's another one of those stories about the call of family that's, I think, built into each of us, and at the same time, the antagonism that some families can get into, and the tension that pulls people both ways, as it does both these sisters, toward each other and away from each other. It really gets me thinking about what will happen to families as a result of this isolation that we're going through now and having all the kids at home, you know, mm-hmm. 24 hours a day.
So the title and author again?
Long Bright River by Liz Moore.
I picked up two short books. One is about only 90 pages long called Mean Girl, about Ayn Rand and the outsized influence this unusual person had on this country and the culture of greed. She wrote two novels that really made her name. One was The Fountainhead. And it is, I read this book when I was no longer in my teens. And I thought, this is the silliest thing I've ever read. It is just ridiculous. But apparently, if you read this as an adolescent, it can change your life.
I was going to say, there were children at Augustana who read that book and who ordered their lives on those principles.
And the impact, I think the malevolent impact it has had on our society is extraordinary. There are some very prominent people in this country who follow her cult of greed and selfishness. And that is one of the defining things of our society today. There's too much of that. But you can trace a lot of it to Ayn Rand. Not a very pleasant person in many ways, personally quite selfish. But in 90 pages, Lisa Dugan runs through her career and tells you something of that impact in the people, the amazing number of people who have, as you say, have directed their lives, because she makes selfishness seem erotic. And it appeals, I can see how it would appeal to a youngster. If you read Ayn Rand in your teens, your life is going to go in that direction.
Well, I think what attracted the kids at Augie that read it is not only the selfishness, but the treatment of Christianity as a slave religion.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It ought to be done away with because it makes all of us slaves and we could be masters. And these students that I knew, you know, were set out to be masters.
Well, she also not only Fountainhead, but she wrote what's the other one?
Fountainhead's the one I'm familiar with.
Yeah, Fountainhead's.
Most of the students read.
Isn't that terrible? I've lost the other one. But the hero of the other one is named Galt, and it is a 5-pound aspirin, as one reviewer put it. And the idea is that as the world falls apart, when the masterful people withdraw, then the poor slaves and menials can't handle life themselves. They just fall apart. And Galt has a place, I think it's in the West, maybe in Colorado, called Galt's Gulch, where the wealthy people retire and wait until the common people have kind of destroyed themselves.
Right.
And then they step forward to take control of the world with Galt making the sign of a dollar in the sky. It's piffle.
She did affect a generation of students.
Oh, yeah. But if you'd like to probe this a bit, it's a simple book, easy to read, by Lisa Dugan, Duggan, called Mean Girl, paper cover, 90 pages. Fascinating book. Over to you.
Book number 3, with an improbable title, and I picked it up only because I had read the author's first novel, which was called The Great Kitchens of the Midwest, a spoof on a 5-star chef who comes out from New York to the Midwest and ends up staying in Iowa, starting a restaurant. The author is J. Ryan Stradall, Stradal. The book is called The Lager Queen of Minnesota. That's the title, The Lager Queen of Minnesota. And if you're from Minnesota, you're going to appreciate this book, I think, a lot more, or if you know people from Minnesota, because it has Minnesotans down proper. Here again, it's a family situation that a dysfunctional family has created. Two young girls. The book begins when these girls now are in their 70s. But it turns out that what set them apart from each other is that the younger girl was her father's favorite, and because she wanted to be a success in life, and because she wanted to become a brewer of beer, because she started drinking beer at 15 and loved it, she talks her father into giving the entire farm to her instead of splitting it with her sister when he died. And the father does that. So here is one sister who has inherited nothing and the other sister who has inherited a fairly wealthy farm. And it traces their lives. It begins with the sister who has inherited nothing, who at 79 is working at Arby's and has worked at Walmart and other places like that, married to a truck driver husband who comes home from the road, drinks a few beers, and sleeps all afternoon. And the other one is in society, and it traces the effect on that inheritance on those two sisters who, again, have not spoken to each other for about 50 years.
Yeah.
But these people are Minnesotans. The sister who inherits all the money is Miss Minneapolis, all get up and go and gung-ho. And the sister who is the loving housewife and goes to PTA and serves church suppers and stuff and is poor is old sleepy St. Paul, right? I mean, it has got Minnesota down proper, and it's a funny and eventually fairly moving, weird book. The Lager Queen of Minnesota.
And the author again?
J. Ryan Stradall. His first book is Kitchens of the Great Midwest.
I have a book I'm going to hand to you when we're done. You will find this the best book you have ever read on writing, on English, on language. I've never read anything like this, Roald. It's called First You Write a Sentence. And that, see if I can find that. For first you write a sentence, and then you chop it small, then mix the bits and sort them out just as they chance to fall. The order of the phrases makes no difference at all. By Lewis Carroll. Boy, does it make a difference. Joe Moran has written a deeply moving book about writing. And every sentence in this is a gem. The guy really knows what he's doing. He starts with the ape that writes sentences about what a sentence is. Then he goes on to nouns and verbs. The neat thing about it is when he talks, he quotes everybody who's ever written anything useful on writing. And some will tell you, you know, you have to write short sentences. And he says, using mostly short words in a sentence has a happy side effect, a richer pattern of sounds. Speech is a bodily thing. We feel the words in our mouths as we shape our jaws, teeth, and lips around them. These chunks of sonic air are made by the same body parts with which we breathe, taste, and kiss. By shutting our lips and humming or closing our throat, or using our tongues, we make the semi-blocked sounds called consonants. By opening our mouths, we make the unblocked sounds called vowels. I read this book slowly, 200 pages, but I spent the time. I wanted to read everything he had to say. Here's another one. Some sentences just need to be long. This is after he makes the case right for short sentences. Some sentences need to be long. The world resists our efforts to enclose it between a capital and a full stop. Why, Malcolm Bowie asked, does Proust write such long, vermiform sentences, always subdividing, then reassembling, loath to come to rest? Because, he says, they mimic the workings of desire and the neurotic rereading of situations we make when we are in love. Their denial and shaky restoration of meaning as eros become visible. Toward the end, at the end of his book, he gives you 20 sentences on sentences. The bones of a sentence are just a noun and a verb, so put the right nouns and verbs on the right slots, and the other words fall into place around them. For his own self, when he closes, he says, I am hoping that a love letter to a small good thing, the sentence, will feel more useful to the reader than an English lesson. Even if I had anything to teach, it wouldn't matter. You only learn to write sentences by reading enough of them and then writing enough of them, although the moment of enough never quite arrives. I knew I could only show you how to make sentences, how I make sentences, by making them and putting them in a book. A worry-making enterprise for sure, since that book now has to stand and fall by its sentences. But doesn't that just make it like any book? So here they are, and here it is, these sentences, this book. The guy, it writes like an angel. And it's a book on how to write that has taught me more than anything I could imagine, and yet he doesn't teach. He inspires. He just inspires you to write. This is a great book. And he says, you know, when you write a sentence, it's not like conversing with somebody because you see that somebody. But here you're writing and you don't know who is going to read it. You have no say over that. It just, you cast the sentence out into the world and it may resonate with somebody or it may never be read again. You just don't know. So it's kind of an act of faith.
Let me add to that a statement I came across about what makes a book good. Are you familiar with the comic strip that's been in the Argus for only a few months now, Macanudo?
Oh, yeah. I've puzzled over that a lot.
Well, what is good? Okay, I have asked countless people what in the world is going on in that comic strip because it makes, there's a different world going on there from mine. But last week, the only panel that had any words in it were a description of what makes a book extraordinary. And it is incredible. Here it is. Uh-huh. And you just proved it there. An extraordinary book is one that is begun by one reader and finished by a different reader.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? A book will change you.
It will. A book can have a profound effect on you. If you're deeply into it and it's worth wading into, boy, can it. And I can't imagine. When I decided to read this, it's because a reviewer said, you know, it's an extraordinary book. I said, well, let's see. And it is. I was hooked from the very first line. And I did not let go of this book until I had finished it. And it took me, I read it off and on over some 3 or 4 days because I went slowly. It's a book to savor. And when I finished, I thought, what did this teach me? And I'm not sure. And yet, at the same time, I feel that I am better equipped now to do what little writing I do than I've ever been in my life. Because of this book by Joe Moran, First You Write a Sentence. And I have never thought about sentences as deeply as I have since reading this book. And we've gone deep into the program and time to slide out. Well, we've gone through some books today, and we hope we inspire you to read to pass the time. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. We are grateful for your company, and we hope we'll have it again next week. Scribble is produced by Media Consultants Limited for Augustana Public Radio.